All right, good morning, golfers. Welcome to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Thank you for joining me on this May 5th, 2018. Happy Cinco de Mayo Day. My friend Steve Goldman in the studio. How you doing, buddy?
Very well, Anthony. Thanks for having me, as always.
What's the news? What do you say today? You got the lowdown on the PGA?
Well, unfortunately, we kind of put the moloik on friend of the program, Eddie Park. So we'll see if we could do better this week. The Wells Fargo Championship, of course, at Quail Hollow Club. 87 players made the cut at +3, which was that's quite a big field. There was a time during the afternoon round where +2 was going to be the cut. And listen to the players that have finished at +2. We got Brooks Koepka, Tiger Woods, Graham McDowell, Rory McIlroy, Phil Mickelson, and Bo Hostler, all in at +2. Tiger actually had to make a 13-footer on 18 just to get to +2, and at the time he thought he needed it to make the cut, but fortunately the cut line one stroke worse than that. But at the top of the leaderboard, we got Peter Malnati leading the field at -7, and you've got Jason Day and rookie Aaron Wise one shot back.
Malnati, you think he's Italian?
Yeah, you
maybe
never know.
Could be. Like he's got that's like Scorsia.
A little bit.
We have to make him a friend of the program.
Yes. Anybody could be a friend of the program.
That's right. How is finally weather breaks.
Yes.
So we're back to actually.
We went from winter to summer in a day.
Like so, that seems to be like a funny joke, a running joke that's a part of Long Islanders, I should say.
Yeah.
But. This was legit.
Oh, yeah.
This was legit.
We went from 50s to 90s in a day, and
yeah.
that's quite an abrupt change. I mean, it's cooled off a little bit. We'll be in the 60s for a little while, so it's going to be really good weather. Fortunately, the rain will stay away from us. Maybe tomorrow a little sketchy with the weather, but otherwise we'll be back to good golfing weather and finally can take the sticks out and, stretch the muscles and either head out to the range and hit some balls or, play nine holes, whatever it is, and finally get the season going.
Well, I'm just glad that Mother Nature decided to flip the switch.
Yes, it was very nice of her to finally say, you know what? It's May. It really should be warm.
Let me throw these guys a bone.
Yes, thank you. And we appreciate that.
Well, I'm looking
Mother
forward.
Mother Nature is a friend of the program also, by the way.
I didn't believe it until recently.
No, that's true.
So looking forward to today's guest, John Cavalier,
yes,
Links
indeed.
Gems. It's going to be should be an interesting conversation. Obviously not a photographer by trade, but certainly has made his name fairly quickly taking pictures or snaps, as they like to say, of some of the most, some of the most historic golf courses around. Certainly he spent a lot of time on the Long Island area. So, just be interested to hear his take on some of the golf courses that we're fortunate to have so close to us.
Yeah. Basically, if there's a golf course, especially like you said, on Long Island that you could think of, or even golf courses that you've never heard of, chances are John's been there. And not only has he been there, but he's actually taken some beautiful photographs of the layouts and not just the golf course itself, but the landscape and the architecture and the clubhouse. So you're absolutely right. I'm looking forward to hearing John's thoughts about his latest travels and what courses he finds to be most fascinating.
All right, you're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. We'll be back in 1 minute.
The Long Island Golf Association is a nonprofit organization of 81 private and public clubs. The LIGA conducts 15 championships annually and works closely with the Long Island Caddy Scholarship Fund. The scholarships are granted to young men and women who are employed at member clubs. For more information on how you can participate in a championship, or if you'd like to donate your time as a volunteer, please call the LIGA at 516-746-1015. That's 516-746-1015, or visit us at www.longislandgolf.org.
Pete's Golf. Since 1979, Pete's Golf has been practicing the art of club fitting and has been selected as a top 100 club fitter by Golf Digest magazine. At Pete's Golf, we use the best technology available to create an exceptional fitting experience for every customer that walks into our store. Visit petesgolf.com or call 516-248-6891. That's 516-248-6891 and get your next set of clubs fit for you.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. I'm Anthony, he's Steve, and on the line is John Cavalier, also known as @LinksGems on Instagram and Twitter. How you doing, John?
Hi, boys, how you doing?
We're doing all right. Are you, is it becoming more you're known as John or more as Lynx Gems at this point? Because you've gathered quite the following, my friend.
Yeah, I guess it depends on where I am. Certainly online, the Lynx Gems handle has become more of an identifier. But in real life, I still do go by John,
right.
both on the golf course and off of it. So,
well, your online presence is certainly why you're part of the program today. That's for sure. And you know, briefly for those who may not know your backstory, although I believe it's become fairly well known, just a little backstory, if you would, briefly about how you got started in all this.
Yeah, sure. Like I always say, I'm a lawyer by trade. It's the job that pays the bills, and I actually love doing it. So it's nice to have both of these things going on. But I got into golf after college, both just as a sport to pick up as I got older and wasn't able to do the things that I could do when I was younger. Fell in love with the game immediately, both from a sporting standpoint and as a business tool. After playing golf for about a decade, for whatever reason, I just happened to take a camera to a golf course on a perfect day. It was actually Somerset Hills. I remember it very clearly. It was a beautiful day after a storm, fall, leaves everywhere, rainbows in the sky, clouds. And it was just a perfect day. So I had a camera with me, grabbed some shots. I'd always had a passing interest in photography, but nothing that was, you know, anything serious. And for whatever reason, that day, happenstance or what have you, just turned out perfectly. I got some great images, and it sparked this interest in golf course photography. And it's meshed perfectly with both my love and obsession, really. I mean, let's be honest, it's an obsession,
right,
with golf. And it's just kind of taken off from there. A couple years ago, a friend of mine who is more social media savvy than I am sort of pushed me toward Twitter as an outlet for these things. I mean, before the social media stuff, I would hang out on some websites like Golf Club Atlas and some other forums and post pictures here and there, which is fun, but the social media stuff is more immediate, it's more direct, it's more interactive with people. So, you know, I was always very reluctant to do that because, frankly, I had no idea what it was all about. But a friend of mine pushed me into it, and you know, from there, it just really took off. I set up a Twitter account. It got popular fast. I set up an Instagram account. After that, same friend told me I needed to do that. I said, okay, fine. You know, you were right the first time. I guess I'll listen to you a second time. And, you know, here we are today. I mean, they've both grown very quickly. And what it really has shown is that there is a extraordinarily strong and passionate community of golf nuts out there on the Internet that are just ravenous for content and discussion and interaction, and just any forum to talk about golf. And I think part of that, and I heard the lead-in segment to me today, I think part of that having to do with us living in the Northeast is that we spend 4 or 5 months a year stuck in our houses, you know, salivating over the arrival of warm weather. And I think that you know, being able to go online and stare and drool at some pictures is a nice outlet for the people like us who are stuck in these areas where the sticks are hung up for a period of time every year. So I think that's been helpful. But that's the backstory. You know, and like you said, it's gone very quickly. Here we are now a couple years later, and it shows no signs of slowing down. So it's been fun. It's been a pretty wild ride.
Absolutely.
And now you're a friend of the program, so now your career is just going to leap exponentially.
And I'm thrilled to be on, guys. I really am. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned Somerset Hills, and of course, took some beautiful pictures there, and obviously this is a radio show, but obviously if you get on to Twitter, Instagram, or you could just search John Cavalier and look at some of the hundreds of photos. But I was curious by your comment about the golf course, because Somerset Hills is a Tillinghast course, and of course you've been to Quaker Ridge and Fenway and Bethpage, you know, the black and the red, Ridgewood and Philadelphia Cricket Club. But you said that Somerset Hills is what your best, the favorite, however you want to describe it, was, let's say, your favorite Tillinghast design. I'm curious as to what is it about Somerset Hills that outdid all the other classic designs?
So you're absolutely right. Somerset Hills is my favorite Tillinghast course, and it's one of my favorite courses anywhere. And I will tell you, you actually brought up an interesting point. Favorite versus best. I will be perfectly honest with you. I've seen a lot of golf courses, but I don't think I'm qualified as an individual to tell you what course is best as compared to others. But I can tell you certainly what my favorite course is, and I can tell you why I think it's better for me than others. And the reason I think Somerset Hills is the best Tillinghast course is because it's so much fun to play. In my experience, and I think I've played most of Tillinghast courses. There's certainly some that I haven't seen. But in my experience, he designs two kinds of courses, at least as they exist today. He designs these championship courses, as I'll call them, like, for example, Wingfoot, Baldus Raw, Cricket Club is sort of a tweener, but it's certainly a test. And these are the courses that he's got that can host even major championships that, for a golfer like me, Baldus Raw is a course that comes to mind is one that does this. They just beat on me constantly. I'm just not good enough to play them the way they're supposed to be played. And as a result, don't get me wrong, I still enjoy playing them, but it can be a bit of a slog for a golfer like me to go out and try to play Baldus Raw the way it's supposed to be played. Same with Wingfoot to a certain extent. But Tillinghast also has these other courses, certainly like Somerset Hills, to some extent like Cricket Club, and he's got a bunch of other ones that have kind of ignored the tendency to sort of become more difficult over the years, and as a result, they're just a whole lot of fun to play. Somerset Hills is a blast, and even a mediocre hack like me can go to Somerset Hills and play the golf course the way it's supposed to be played, hit some greens, make some pars, have a look at birdie, and really, to me, that's the sign of a golf course that is really, truly great, is that I can go out there, I can play with a scratch guy or a plus handicapper, and I can play with an 18 handicapper, and we can all have a good time and enjoy the golf course. Nobody gets overwhelmed, and nobody finds it too easy. It's enjoyable for golfers of all skill levels, and I think Tillinghast was really good at that. I happen to think Somerset Hills is the best example of it. The other thing that I love about Somerset Hills is it's got a great variety of golf holes. It's very beautiful, obviously. For those who have been there, like the front nine and the back nine are significantly different. The front nine is more open and level, whereas the back nine sort of plays through this wooded area down around a pond and through some corridors between trees. So it's a really nice dichotomy. Somehow it doesn't feel disjointed. It's just, it's really close to, in my view, the perfect 100-year-old golf course. The club does a great job maintaining it. The greens are always perfect. It's just a wonderful place to play around.
How important was when you look back on it, you fell in love with Somerset Hills, and like you said, there's a difference between maybe the best and the favorite, and who's to say what the best is, but the soundness of the architectural principles of Somerset Hills, and how is that, how has that changed your perspective going forward from your experience there?
I think it had a huge impact on me. And, for example, on the West Coast, San Francisco Golf Club is sort of what I view as the Somerset Hills sister course. Same type of thing there. It's architecturally perfect. It's well-preserved in the sense that Tillinghast's design is still there in most of its form. Now, all these courses have been changed or tweaked a little bit. Some of them have been restored, and some of them have remained at least mostly untouched. They've all changed, but these are courses that I think best show the real design principles that the guys like Tillinghast operated by. And Philly Cricket's a great example. I think Philly Cricket is sort of a hybrid between the two, because it used to be very much a difficult golf course. And then when Keith Foster came in and took it back to Tillinghast's original design, it regained those fun, enjoyable architectural features that make it so much fun to play.
Keith Foster, another friend of the program. I want to actually, this would probably be a good time because I want to take a short break because I have some questions regarding the architectural principles, one that you've been exposed to varying degrees of them and the implementation of them. But let's take a short break. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
Hi, I'm Dr. Frank Rossi of Cornell University. As the stewards of New York's golf course, the superintendents are dedicated to protecting our natural resources. In heavily developed areas like Long Island, golf courses offer large expanses of open space that provide environmental benefits, such as allowing water to infiltrate into the ground naturally and providing habitat for native species such as bees and butterflies. To help manage golf courses in harmony with the environment, the state's golf industry has established a comprehensive best management practices program to educate and serve as a resource for superintendents. For more information, see our website at nysgolfbmp.cals.cornell.edu.
Owning the latest and greatest golf equipment makes no difference if it's not fit perfectly for your game. At Mizuno, we create irons and woods for all skill level golfers, from our MP18 family featuring three different models designed for the better player to our JPX family featuring three different models designed to give you distance and forgiveness. We have a model for everybody. Visit Pete's Golf Shop and get custom fit for a set of Mizunos today.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. I'm Anthony, he's Steve, and on the line is John Cavalier, also known as @LinksGems on Twitter and Instagram. John, we were talking about architectural principles, and I was just curious in terms of, you know, as you fell in love with the game and particularly golf course architecture, for those of us who may be not as educated as you in those terms.
Not as nerdy.
Well, just, I mean, it's something that I think that I've recently, I've never been as nerdy, if you will, but I've become, but through people like yourself.
Passionate. Let's say that word.
Right. Like, you know, through people like yourself and others via social media, I've become, you know, more interested. My question to you is, since you've been down this path, how does one, other than, let's say, going to the library and taking out 10 books on golden age of golf course architecture, as one plays a game, how does one try to educate themselves in golf course architecture and maybe some strategy and principles?
Well, let me warn you first. If you're thinking about going down this path, it is a dark and dangerous road.
Right.
Anthony's not afraid.
Yeah.
So if you're brave enough to take a jump, there's a couple ways to go about it. I mean, look, I like golf books as much as the next guy, but there's really only so much you can get from a book. I mean, you want to go out there and you want to put your feet on the ground and your eyes on the course, and that's really how I think the best way to go about doing it. But if the way I did it, and I can speak to my own sort of journey down that path, is that I was, even as recently as a couple years ago, I had really no interest or knowledge about golf course architecture. You know, one course was really the same as the next to me. I mean, if you put it next to an ocean or on top of a mountain, I would probably like it better than a course in the middle of a cornfield. But beyond that, you know, I was kind of clueless. And then I played a couple of C.B. McDonald courses. And the first one I played was Sleepy Hollow, again, up your way, obviously, in Westchester. And within a very short period of time after that, I played Piping Rock, Creek Club, and Yale. And that really sparked an obsession for me in learning about this C.B. McDonald guy who built all these golf courses, and certainly his protege, Seth Rayner, who built even more of these golf courses that used these template hole designs that were taken from sort of what C.B. McDonald viewed as the best of the hole designs in the British Isles, brought them over here, adapted them to whatever site they were working on at the time, and followed this belief that these holes exemplify these perfect golf architectural principles and that they could be duplicated in various sites and adapted to various, you know, kinds of designs. And so, for those of you who don't know, you go play a C.B. McDonald course and you'll see a lot of the same hole designs from course to course to course. The par threes are usually all the same. There's a short hole, there's an Eden design, there's a Redan par three, and a lot of times, depending on the course, there's a Biarritz par three. So you go from course to course to course, and you recognize these same holes, and you see how McDonald and Rayner and later Banks and even Tillinghast at Somerset Hills adapted these hole designs that they believed were either perfect or of the highest merit, and laid them on the ground in these different locations in such a way that it fit together and made a golf course. I just found that very interesting and very neat, and I enjoyed seeing these different iterations of these template concepts at these different courses. And so I started reading about Stephen McDonald, but more importantly, I started seeking out his courses and Rayner's designs and seeing more of them. And as you go, I think you kind of naturally pick these things up. You know, the Internet's a great tool nowadays. You really don't need to stock up on all these dusty old expensive golf books, although I admit to doing that. I don't think it's necessary. Certainly Golf Club Atlas is the best resource online for anyone who wants to geek out for a couple hours on golf course architecture. I mean, the rabbit hole there is really deep, but it's extraordinarily interesting to people like me. And to anyone who really wants to learn about this stuff, there's a discussion forum there, there's resources, there's references to certain books that you can use. I mean, it's really the starting point for anybody, I think, who wants to dive down this path.
Our guest this morning is John Cavalier, noted golf photographer. You can find him on Twitter at LynxGems, also on Instagram. John, I've noticed with your photography, you seem to have an equal affinity to clubhouses, and I'm wondering, in an architecture, is the design of a clubhouse either exclusive of the golf course? Is there a synergy involved, or is there just, it's just a pretty building and you just like taking pictures of it?
Yeah, so that's a great point. And again, I give you my opinion on it. I think the very best clubhouses and the very best clubs are the places where the clubhouse suits the golf course and vice versa. Because, as you pointed out, I mean, there's all kinds of different clubhouses. I mean, take the clubhouse at Sleepy Hollow, like we mentioned earlier, which is a Vanderbilt mansion that has 100 rooms in it, and compare it with the clubhouse at Shinnecock that is tiny and unassuming and, you know, one story high, and it looks like a little old vacation home from 100 years ago. And I think both of them are perfect. They suit their courses and their clubs to a T. And those, to me, are the clubhouses that best do their clubs justice and the ones I enjoy seeing the most. On the other hand, you can have a great-looking clubhouse that just flat-out doesn't work or doesn't fit or that's over the top. Or, you know, maybe we have a super-modern clubhouse and a golf course that's trying to emulate the principles of old-school design. Or vice versa. You know, you have a very classic-looking clubhouse and a very modern golf course, and it just... it doesn't work. You said it perfectly. It's the synergy that I think draws me and others to like certain clubhouses better than others.
John, if you could only shoot one golf course or play one golf course, I think, you know, the visual experience is not necessarily mutually exclusive with the playing experience. Would they be the same, one and the same for you in terms of the golf course?
That's a tough question, but I will tell you, National Golf Links is my favorite golf course to play, and it's probably my favorite golf course to shoot. The only one that even really comes close would be Cypress Point. That's just such a fun course to shoot because it's so damn beautiful that, I mean, you just can't take a bad picture there. Everywhere you turn your head, you're looking at, you know, it's a pain. It's just an amazing spot, but it would certainly be one of those two. I love National Golf Links. I can spend every day of my life there. I think it's a perfect golf course, and it's obviously very beautiful, so there's a lot of neat shots there, as there are so many courses up on Long Island.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to play there as well, and it is my favorite golf course that I've been fortunate enough to play. Now, my you know, CV is not as expansive as yours, but I have been fortunate to play a few good ones, and that still remains you know, untoppled at the top of my list. And I just think, you know, there's a visceral feeling there, I think, when you play there. And it's not
very
just
much so.
It's the textures of the place. It's the visuals, obviously the golf course itself, all of it, the way it melds together. And as to Steve's point, the way the clubhouse, the way that's framed, and just all of that makes it really a sort of, for someone who loves golf, and loves that style of golf. I mean, given the choice, for me, I would choose Lynx Golf or, you know, even though we maybe it's not, you know, Ireland or Scotland, but I choose Lynx golf over aerial golf per se, or modern American golf. And so, you know, you throw that all into the mix, and to me, it's just beautiful, really. There's no other way to describe it as beautiful.
I agree with everything you just said. I mean, the thing that I love so much about National Golf Links, in addition to what you were just talking about, is that the amazing thing to me there is that every shot you stand over there, you have choices.
Yep.
No matter what your skill level, whether you're scratch or you can barely get the ball off the ground, you have options and choices and an ability to get the ball around no matter how well you play. I mean, if you know your skill level and you trust your game and are realistic about it, you can go play National Golf Links and shoot a good score, even if you're by far from a good golfer. Whereas even if you're a college player or a scratch guy, I mean, I just saw the Walker Cup a few years ago, it's not like these guys who are, you know, plus five go out there and just destroy the place either. I mean,
it can
defend itself against great golfers. And I think that those options and choices and the ability of various skill levels to play the place are, again, just the highest indication that you're looking at a golf course that is architecturally solid and good. And I don't think anywhere embodies that more than National Golf Links. I think it's as close to a perfect golf course as you can find in the country.
I listened to your buddy, the Fried Eggs, interview with Jeff Ogilvie, and that would be my choice for the location for the Six Club contest between some professionals. To me, that seems like the perfect venue to get a couple of pros. Even if it was like, you know, maybe not. Even if you don't want to get make it a tournament out of it, maybe you just either invite a handful, or maybe you make it like a Shell's Wonderful World of Golf type of thing. But a Six Club championship would be with a couple of the best players in the world. That would be a fun place to watch that.
I totally agree with you.
Perfect. Yeah, exactly. Just while we're on NGLA, do you have any information regarding the fire in terms of, you know, how extensive it was or how bad it was?
Sure. So, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, they had a fire there, I guess it was about 2 weeks ago now. And I apologize for using the insider term, but the place is called the Birdhouse. It's the little screened-in porch area that extends off of, I guess it's the west side of the building.
Yep.
Overlooks the Taconic Bay, and it's a popular spot, but fortunately it's sort of disconnected. It's an addition. It's not part of the original clubhouse, so it was built later. And the information that I have is that they were doing the roof. They were doing roof repairs there, and a machine that the roofers had up top sparked a little fire.
Okay.
It was windy up there, which caused the fire to get worse and spread pretty quickly. But, again, my understanding is that the wind was blowing east to west, so it kept it away from most of the other parts of the building, which, if you've ever been in it, is like a golf museum. I mean, it contains all kinds of incredible, priceless relics from the club, from C.B. McDonald, and from other golf clubs, both Golden Age and current. So, nevertheless, my understanding is that the fire damage was limited to the birdhouse and mostly on the roof, and that'll need some repairs. They did get some water in the lobby area from the spraying of the fire hoses on top of the birdhouse to put the fire out. And there's some concern that there might be some saltwater damage since it was bay water that was pumped up and sprayed on the fire.
Right.
But, you know, so they have some white streaking in the clubhouse and in the lobby. And the lobby has all these beautiful murals painted on the walls.
Sure.
Are just incredible. And I think that there is some worry that they might need repair. But overall, my understanding is they got very lucky that damage is extraordinarily minimal and that nothing of historical value was lost, which is really good because, like I said, National lost its original clubhouse way back in the 19-teens.
Right.
And they've been in that clubhouse ever since. And, again, for those of your listeners that have been there, that building is really a special place.
Oh, yeah.
And it would have been a real tragedy, at least in the golf world, as far as tragedies go. I mean, there's real-life tragedies, there's golf tragedies.
Right.
Nobody was hurt. But to lose a place like that and what it contained, at least in the golfing context, would have been a real tragedy.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a special clubhouse. It's beautiful inside and out. I only have, to finish up, I just have two requests, actually. Number one, since you spend enough time up here, that next time you do come up here, I hope you give me a call. Be fun. I think it would be fun to play around with you.
I'd love it.
And two, when I'm down, if I ever come down there, which I may be down this summer, that I hope you and I can get a play around. And I'm less interested in playing with you as much as I am playing with Gracie. I'd like to. she looks like a beautiful dog and a fun companion. And I, like yourself, have a few dogs myself and always had dogs. So, but Gracie looks like she was born to the golf course.
She absolutely loves it out there. I take her out anytime I can. My club here is open to letting us bring our dogs on the courses, just like the courses over in Scotland. So yep. I take advantage of that whenever I can. And listen, certainly anytime I'm up there or down here, I will let you know. I mean, the real benefit for me in doing this and the highlight of this whole process for me has been meeting all these wonderful golf nuts like myself.
Yep.
You know, playing rounds with guys and talking to them about our ridiculous obsession with this game. And so anytime I can tee it up with somebody or meet somebody new, I'm always happy to do that. And look, I mean, don't tell anybody down my way here, but as far as we go in Philly, we have some great golf here, and I will argue until I'm blue in the face that Philly has the best golf in the United States. But for my own preferences, I always like coming up to the New York area and certainly out on Long Island for my golf. So I'm sure we can make that happen before too long.
Sounds good. Thank you for your time this morning, John. It was a pleasure to have you on.
Hey, guys. It's been a pleasure on my end, too. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, John.
Take care. All right. That was John Cavalier at Lynx Golf, at Lynx Gems on social media, Instagram and Twitter. Steve, we got to wrap it up, man. Always a pleasure, my friend.
We'll see you next week. Players' Championship Week.
On par with Anthony Scorsia.